Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This is your host, Dr. Hal Schurz, and along with my co-host, Dr. Michael Karuchik, we come to you every week thanks to the generous support of the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. And we discuss topics here on this show that doctors discuss amongst themselves on all healthcare issues imaginable. And we let you in on those private discussions so that you'll be armed with the information that you'll need to fight for your healthcare freedom. A word about the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. It's a non-for-profit, tax-deductible organization founded by doctors who are deeply concerned with the direction that healthcare is going in, and we offer solutions very different from those that have been enacted by bureaucrats in Washington who believe they know better than you do about the kind of healthcare you should have, who should deliver it to you, and where. The foundation has been fighting for healthcare freedom for all Americans and trying to preserve the doctor-patient relationship, very much in jeopardy right now. So go to their website, www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org, and contribute generously to allow the people in Docs for Patient Care to carry on the fight for you on your behalf. You might not think you need to get involved with this, but let me assure you that you do, because if you're not a patient yet, someday you will be, and you'll want the doctor of your choice there to take care of you. Well, today I have the privilege of having two other healthcare freedom fighters with me, two men who've worked very hard at fighting for healthcare freedom for all Americans. They come to us from Arizona, and one I'm very, very good friends with, and the other is his colleague out there in the Phoenix area. John Ammon and Jeff Singer are joining us today. Just a word about each. John is a practicing anesthesiologist. He's been in private practice, in academic practice. He's been the president and a director on the American Board of Anesthesiology, and he was the initial president of the Docs for Patient Care Arizona chapter, and an inaugural member of the board of the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. Jeff Singer is a general surgeon in private practice and the founder of Valley Surgical Clinics, which is the largest and oldest group of private surgical practice surgeons in Arizona. He has been working with the Arizona Healthcare he's been working with the Arizona Medical Association. No, that's not right either. You can correct me, Jeff, but he's an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and writes extensively on healthcare issues, health policy issues. And we thought it would be fun to have them on the show today to discuss something very unique that they created, which is a healthcare course that they taught through Arizona State University on healthcare system, healthcare reform, and it's entitled How We Got Into This Mess and How We Get Out. So without any further ado, let me welcome both of you gentlemen into the Doctor's Lounge.
Good morning, Hal. How are you?
Good morning.
Good. Hello, gentlemen. Well, you know, let's just get right into the course that you created, which I think is incredible and something that is very unique. I don't know any course of its kind anywhere else that's been taught in any other university in America. Can you comment on that?
Well, the course is under the aegis of the Center for Political Thought and Leadership, which is a center that it was within the Department of History at ASU. And we are two of the 15 members of the board of that center. We've been honored to be involved in that as the healthcare policy people. And we were invited to do a course that is basically an adult outreach. This was not to undergraduates, but to adults in the Phoenix metropolitan area about the current situation in healthcare, specifically focused on the financing crisis and some of the relationship of that crisis to the Affordable Care Act and what potential reform options we have as a nation. And it was a 10-hour course. You know, Jeff and I split the hours, and we've got a 77-page syllabus, which is part of our project. And it was tremendously successful. In fact, we finished it about a week ago, and it was incredibly well received.
Yeah, we thought there would be everybody always just discusses the issue of healthcare financing and now the Affordable Care Act, sort of in a vacuum, in the actual present context. They're not. It's almost like they're in the moment rather than looking at it from the overall holistic perspective. So we decided we designed this course to basically take us back to the founding of this country. And we talked about how medicine was practiced in the colonies and then how it changed in the 1800s. We kind of basically told the whole story of the evolution of America's healthcare system from the beginning until where we are exactly right now. And the people taking this journey with us were able to see that basically the history of America's healthcare system is a history of the progressive encroachment of government into the healthcare marketplace. And it started actually originally at the behest of the practitioners who organized through state legislatures to create the healthcare cartel that exists today. I mean, there is we have to face it. We have a cartel. So first, the practitioners were using government to get them protection and special status and to protect their incomes and to control the educational system and production of physicians. Then later, the politicians stepped in to give out a bunch of free goodies to people. And then when the unintended consequences of giving out all those free goodies were felt, that is, we started a healthcare inflation, basically, and costs became out of control. Then the government got further involved to try to bring those things under control. And so basically, by the time we got up to the Affordable Care Act in our course, it was understood by everyone, and that was just the latest chapter in a whole long series of encroachments and intrusions into the healthcare marketplace and into the patient-doctor relationship. So when you understand it in that perspective, it makes it it's better for you when you want to decide, well, what do we need to do to fix this, when you understand that it's not just a simple matter of deductibles and co-pays. There's an entire complex web of intrusions that we have to address.
Absolutely. Well, I think historical context always helps us to solve problems that we face today. And if you don't know the lessons of history, you're doomed to repeat them. We've heard that over and over again. I'm very interested to just talk a little bit more about the whole logistics of the course, and because it's a fascinating concept, being able to bring this message to the public, because that's what the Doctor Patient Care Foundation is all about. It's about educating the public, because if we have an uneducated populace, That's the reason why we are in the mess we're in. They don't understand what's happening. So how many people were in your course?
Almost 30 people.
Wow.
And they were people that really represented a big cross section of society. We had some attorneys. We had physicians. We had a federal magistrate. We had a number of people from Blue Cross. A number of people from other insurance agencies and brokerage firms and so forth.
And a few doctors.
Yeah, right. And so it was a cross-section of people who, you know, in at least the local areas, are decision-makers about health care and health care resources and health care benefits in different parts of our local economy and society.
So is this course going to be offered again?
Well, we have an opportunity, actually, to develop a series of videos. Remember how it was a 10-hour course, 40 minutes of each hour were either Jeff or I presenting the concepts within that hour's content. So we wound up with about 6.5 to 7 hours of actual speaking dialogue to the audience. And we are about to embark on a project that will consolidate those 6.5 to 7 hours down to 1 hour of scripting, and then that scripting will be broken into about 10 to 15 videos that will have, you know, B-rolls and, you know, enhancements with all kinds of video additions with a professional crew that will then educate people in the different areas of the course that we presented, and it'll be done as a national project.
Is that going also is that also through ASU?
No, not at all. It's through the Institute for Humane Studies at the George Mason University in Virginia, and we're about to embark on this, and the launch date is in April.
The Institute for Humane Studies has a project called Learn Liberty Online. There's actually a website, learnliberty.org, and they actually design online courses for college students. You know, basically, there are a lot of college students out there starving for information about first principles, about economics, about history, and a lot of them feel that they're you know, getting indoctrinated in universities these days, and they're not getting the kind of information they want. So the Institute for Humane Studies makes this information available, and in fact, Learn Liberty had 15 million hits last year. So they're designing a course that's aimed at undergraduate students to take on demand and based upon our course. And so that's very exciting because we'd like to get the word out to a lot more people than the people who just took our continuing education course.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the possibilities, my head is spinning just talking to you guys because the possibilities are limitless. You could make this available to every medical student and provide them with a CD to educate them and teach them things that they don't learn in medical school.
Well, Hal, interestingly, in terms of that exposure and that ramping up or leveraging of this information, this knowledge, the Institute for Humane Studies Learn Liberty program has 15 million hits by undergraduates a year on their site with their various videos that, you know, talk, as Jeff said, the first principles, founding principles, economics, and so free market theory and so forth. So I think this fits right into that, and particularly timely today with the King Burwell SCOTUS case, the Supreme Court case next month, and its consequences in June and so forth. So we think the timing of our effort and our project here is just perfect.
Yeah, we'll talk more about the specifics of the issues that you talked about in your course a little bit later in the show. We'll just try to wrap up some of these logistics about the actual course itself. So do you think that there is an appetite to make this into an actual undergraduate course? That's not an online course, but a physical
course?
Well,
there are some political difficulties. That's, you know, the Center for Political Thought and Leadership at Arizona State University is a fully accredited, approved center within the university that actually designs and teaches courses for both undergraduate and graduates in history and political philosophy. And this is being given under their auspices. But there are bureaucracies and politics at play at any of these major universities. So it originally was hoped that we could give this course on the campus for the students, but there are issues because we don't have credentials in history, even though we are doctors and doctorates and know probably a lot more about the history of medicine than any member of the history faculty of most universities in the country. We don't have degrees in history, so there's a problem with us teaching in the history department.
Absolutely. Well, you know, this is just fantastic, and we'll talk about the specifics of the course and some of the other issues in healthcare that you've been talking about when we get back from this break. So my guests are Drs. John Ammon and Jeffrey Singer, and you're in the Doctor's Lounge.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back into the Doctor's Lounge. This is Dr. Hal Schurz with my very special guests, Dr. Jeffrey Singer and Dr. John Ammond, two of the leading healthcare freedom fighters in Phoenix, Arizona, who've created a course that has been taught through Arizona State University on America's healthcare system. Fellas, you know, we were talking about the logistics of the course. Now I want to get into some of the specifics. I went through the entire syllabus, and I thought it was fantastic. You guys did just a yeoman's job of putting that together, and my hat is off to you. It was fantastic.
Well, thank you.
And I saw some things in there that I wanted to specifically talk about, and also everybody is a critic, and so everybody I had a few things that I didn't see in there that I thought might be good if you're going to modify this or make additions. But Jeff, you talked a few minutes about the medical cartel, which is how your course started off, and the tone that I'm hearing from you is that might not be such a good thing. Do you care to comment?
Yeah, I don't think it is a good thing. If we're interested in the freedom of choice for the patient, and we look at the patient as a consumer of healthcare, just as people are consumers of food and clothing, they need to have maximum choice. So if you look at the history, it's important to understand, and if you want to address the problems that we're facing, you need to realize that none of the actors in this drama are pure. They all have done things wrong. Now, our ancestors, obviously none of us were around for this, but our ancestors strove throughout the 1800s to develop a special status for the medical profession that was enjoyed by medical practitioners in Europe, many of them trained and were exposed. Here they didn't really have that status. There was a lot of competition. And in the 1800s, of course, there were various schools of thought because the science hadn't evolved very much in medicine. So you had an effort by what we call regular doctors. They're our ancestors, the ancestors of the allopathic physicians. They actually strove hard. In fact, the AMA was created in 1846 with the mission of getting state legislatures to license doctors. Now, this may sound to listeners as, well, what's the big deal? Well, believe it or not, there was no such thing as licensing of anything in this country in those days. When they would go to state legislatures in the early 1800s, they would be rebuffed. They were told, licensing? This is America. You don't need a license to work.
It was the Wild West.
Just do your work.
Right.
But,
It was the Wild West. Everything.
Well, it wasn't the Wild West. It was a free country,
right,
I would say. And then later on, after the Civil War, people's attitudes changed. Certain trades had gotten legislatures to get licensing done, licensed plumbers, licensed contractors. So the concept of licensing was suddenly not as alien in this country. And the whole idea of licensing, it's always, every time any group in the economy has sought licensing, it's never been the customers or the consumers that have sought the licensing. It's always been the providers. And it's always under the guise of, we need to do this to protect the consumer from people who are not as good as us. And so what it does is, of course, is it protects the practitioner from competition. And originally, when they started to succeed in getting state legislatures to license doctors, the licensing boards consisted of the state medical associations. So it's very similar to, certain cities like New York where you have the unions controlling. You can't get a job as a plumber unless you belong to the union, and you can't get into the union unless you worked as a plumber. And so the union kind of keeps control of how many plumbers there are going to be. Well, that's the same way it was in healthcare, in medicine. And eventually, then we get into our course how they got basically control through the licensing boards of who, of what medical schools are considered acceptable to graduate from in order to get a license. So what it does is it controls the supply and the philosophy of doctors. And now, nowadays, of course, there's not, as science has grown in healthcare, by the turn of the 20th century, beginning of the 20th century, really there weren't so many schools of thought because they all converged based upon the new science and scientific information. But that's not the point. The point was that the AMA succeeded by the 1920s in pretty much having a tight control of how many doctors are produced each year, and they had to have fealty to their state medical associations. Very similar to, like I say, we see in certain big cities, particularly older cities back east, like New York, where you can't get into the plumbing trade unless you belong to the plumbing union, et cetera. We already talked about that. So even in Hollywood.
let me pull you back into where we are then today. So based on what you've said, then you would have no problem with nurse practitioners saying that they're doctors and delivering care, or John, anesthesia PAs going ahead and posing as fully qualified anesthesiologists.
No, I don't think that is the implication of what Jeff just said, or the component of the course that talked about the development of the quote-unquote cartel. I think the context was more like any other profession, legal, dental, or whatever, there was an effort to consolidate a certain quality level of physicianhood early in the country, and then it evolved further along with dramatic changes in science and the various, you know, types of medical therapies and the sophistication of medicine. And, you know, Jeff and I, we didn't disagree, but we kind of approached it from a different point of view, in that my feeling was it was basically the establishment of the profession. And the profession, very much like the legal or the dental or any other profession, is somewhat of a cartel, and that there were certain issues that had to be addressed to develop that solidarity within the physician population in America. But again, it also reflected the disjointed and incredible variation of skill and training and education and so forth of physicians all through the 1800s, and that didn't really change until we got into the 1900s with the Flexner Report and the kind of coordination of medical education and the development of specialty medicine that occurred after that. So it really was the development of a profession.
Yeah, but the point we make, and later on when we deal with you know, how to address our problem, we in our concluding lectures, we point out this is not just about reforming the insurance system. So, for example, no, I do not believe a person who's not a doctor should be able to fraudulently portray himself or herself as a doctor. So, no, I don't believe that. But I do believe that that a lot of these scope of practice restrictions that to this day the medical cartel keeps in place in all of the states, and it varies from state to state about the restrictions, they need to be minimized, because that's part of helping consuming patients get affordable health care. So, for example, if people of modest means who just want to get maybe an annual physical and some vaccinations may decide, you know, for this, I think a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, it's all I need right now. If I want something more complicated, I'll be the judge of whether I want to go to somebody who's graduated medical school and is board certified in a specialty. But right now, all I want is just to get my cholesterol checked and a wellness exam and get my vaccinations up to date. But in many states, that can't be done because the state licensing boards controlled by the medical profession have strict restrictions on who can do those kind of things.
Yes, but it's a slippery slope.
And that's what we're talking about. You want to, you know, liberalize the options for the consuming patient.
Well, it's a slippery slope, I think, because, you know, there are some states, like Kentucky, for example, where optometrists can do laser eye surgery with 300 hours of online training. And so when you mention the fact that the cartels are doing this for self-serving interests and not to protect the public, well, that may be true to some extent, but yet I think that there is a certain amount of public protection that comes from honing your profession and being an expert in it. And so yes, I think that it would be great for people to be able to say that they want to go to a nurse practitioner instead of going into a medical office to get a well check. But, you know, somebody has to decide, well, which situations are acceptable for non-physicians to deliver care and which are not acceptable. Well, and somebody's going to always...
That's where John and I might differ. I'm a little more...
Libertarian?
Yeah. I am a libertarian, yeah. And so I would say that there's a lot of things that would decide that. There are certification boards. There's a marketplace. I think it's the choice. In other words, I think it's arrogant for us to decide that we should decide for the people what is safe for them. I think individuals are adults, and they need to make their own decisions. And we do that every day in every other field. So, for example, in the field where there's no licensing, there's all sorts of, there's a demand for and need for businesses that give information to consumers that evaluate. You got this may not be appropriate for medicine, but Yelp, for example, and for medicine, there's all sorts of health grades, that sort of thing. So I think a rational person who's seeking LASIK eye surgery, for example, first thing you do, because LASIK eye surgery is not covered by insurance in most cases.
That's
so
correct.
First thing a person does, that's a real market-driven area for that you used as an example. People shop around. They want to know what their results are. They want to know what people thought of the place. They want to know how much it costs. They want to know what kind of training this guy has, how many has he done. So I think it's presumptuous of us, even if our intentions are completely pure, to say, I'm going to protect you from making the wrong choice. Because those people are grown-ups just like we are.
You know what, Jeff? I think that you're giving people a lot of credit. And you're a surgeon, and as am I. And the patient population that I take care of for a large part of my patient population is a very uneducated, unsophisticated group of people, and they don't even know who I may have even operated on them, and they don't know my name, or they don't know, they don't remember who the surgeon who took care of them was in my group. And so I think that you for a lot of people, yes, they do have a lot of sophistication. They'll ask the questions that you have raised, but a lot of people, are unsophisticated, and I think that there's a fine line of, it's like snake oil.
That would get us into another topic, which is a lot of those patients that you mentioned don't have any skin in the game, because you're talking about the third-party payer, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare or a private insurance company, taking all of the responsibility away from the patient, because they're not, for the most part, paying for it. If they were paying for it, believe me, they'd want to know, what's the name of this guy that I'm going to give money to who's going to operate on me? They'd be much more concerned about that, but a lot of patients, they don't care. It's being taken care of by the third party. It's mm-hmm. I see that, too. I'm a general surgeon, and I have a substantial portion of my practice is heavily third party, including Medicaid and Medicare. And the less a person is responsible for their health care, the less they check things out, because it's just taken care of for them. To the point sometimes where they even have to have me get them a cab to get back home from the office, because they suddenly don't want to call a cab on their own. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Patient transport. Yeah, I agree with much of what you said, but I do think that there is a role for government or some body to oversee quality or other kinds of delivery measures for this kind of thing. But you know what?
Well, I hope we can agree, though, that we could at least liberalize the stranglehold that the cartel has in many states. So, for example,
Jeff, it's a hard break right now, so we'll get back to that point in the next segment. Hal Schurz in the Doctor's Lounge.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge. This is Dr. Hal Schertz with my very special guests, Dr. Jeffrey Singer and John Ammon, talking about healthcare reform. They created a course at Arizona State University which really went over all aspects of healthcare right from the very beginning of healthcare in America. Before the break, we were talking about the third-party payment system, Jeff. We were talking about that people don't have skin in the game, and that may be why they're not taking responsibility for their own health care. That really is the crux of why costs have spiraled out of control, isn't it?
It is. And, Hal, if I can just address for a moment, the history is fascinating in that it wasn't until World War II when the National War Board, you know, because of wage and price controls that were placed on the American workplace because of the inflation potential with all the soldiers away and inadequate labor supply, that the health benefits were considered non-wages. And that alignment or that linkage of employment and health insurance began at that point. And that's when it became almost a birthright for all employed people. And then directly after the war, the unions then began to use the collective bargaining, facility from FDR's New Deal, and then the Taft-Hartley Act restated that, and ba-doom, unions now had health care through their employment forevermore. And so that third-party mechanism, followed by the Great Society's Medicare and Medicaid, the ultimate third-party payers, was put into place for the vast majority of Americans getting health care. And so the skin in the game was removed, and to this day is a major problem. And that is the cost of, that's the cause, as you said, the crux of the matter of the financing crisis in healthcare today. It's the fact that people either expect first dollar coverage or minimal payment out of pocket, and they are spending other people's money or what is perceived to be other people's money, and there's no consumerism, there's no price transparency, there's nothing. It's all based on stuff done at the insurance level and at the government level.
And it's not just the patients, it's all of us. You know,
right.
The doctor and the patient are spending somebody else's money.
Exactly.
So for example, we always talk about the role of defensive medicine and healthcare costs. It's easier to cover your bases and order a couple of extra tests just to have a paper trail when you don't feel like the patient's going to be paying for it. The third party is taking care of it. So all of us tend to, I'm not thinking about when I recommend a workup to my patient isn't asking how much is this going to cost, and I'm not thinking how much is this going to cost.
Right.
I'm just taking the path of least resistance.
And most
right.
of the time,
and
you don't know.
Mechanism.
And most of the time, you don't know what it costs, right, Jeff?
Right, because nothing's transparent, because everybody's. And I actually had an article about this called Healthcare's Third Party Payment Trap. It was in Reason.com, where I point out that, it's basically the providers, the hospitals, doctors, et cetera, are negotiating with a third party. They're not negotiating with the patient. So they have a list price schedule used as a negotiation tool. If they're negotiating directly with the patient, there'd be totally different price arrived at.
You know, I want to talk about the Supreme Court, but this is an upcoming case. But what you just said, I think, is something that this is a great time to bring this up about costs and about the fact that they're spiraling out of control. And there are two things that weren't in your syllabus that maybe you talked about in the course, but I think are part of the reason why costs are so out of control. And one is the lack of competition, and that's because of the fact that doctors can't compete in the marketplace because of federal regulation, stark regulation, or anti-kickback regulation, and the transition of power in healthcare from physicians to hospitals. You want to comment on those things?
I think both of those things are key things, and we actually did talk a great deal about that. The hospital issue really is the transfer through the Affordable Care Act to accountable care organizations, which is the collectivization of hospital care with employment of physicians and the virtual removal of physicians as private practitioners and any kind of an economic factor in the overall cost structure of medicine. So the hospitals, through the Affordable Care Act, have really consumed the entire healthcare market, or will, in the ultimate disposition of the ACA, if it stands as a law.
Yeah, that's the goal, actually. The goal is to try to model it after the system in England, where a lot of people may not realize this, but just like in the United States, where you shop around for a house in a good school district because that's where your kid's going to go to school, well, under the national health system in England, there are health districts. So where you live determines what hospital is going to be your hospital and what doctors and what clinic are going to be your doctors, period. So that's their goal here. They think that's going to actually... That consolidation is going to lead to decreased costs. But, of course, anybody who took high school-level economics knows that when industries consolidate, costs go up. I mean, that was what motivated the Antitrust Act back in the late 1800s.
Yeah. And as far as competition goes, I think that's a key issue. And we address competition verbally as we presented the course, how on multiple levels, one of which is the lack of competition with insurance companies, you know, a third-party payer system in America that is basically, because of the McCarran-Ferguson Act in 1945, basically is relegated to insurance commissions in each state. So there's no sales of insurance across state lines. And importantly, there's no competition within Medicare or Medicaid. Those are fixed by the federal government. And there's absolutely no competition that's based on quality or any dollars out of people's pockets.
Yeah.
So there is no competition.
Yeah, in fact, there's a hospital cartel. We talked about the medical cartel. There's a hospital cartel and there's an insurance cartel. I mean, the insurance industries in each state are enjoying a cozy relationship with their regulators. They don't want competition across state lines. They got a nice situation where they are within their states.
It's a superb model of regulatory capture, which is where the industry being regulated often captures the regulators, and it's kind of an incestuous relationship, as Jeff just referred to it. And we're seeing that the ACA and the progressive intrusion since 1965 and all of the governmental efforts to try to control costs are all competition limiting or competition eliminating, and it's one of the problems. And you know, I go back to the basic philosophical thing: is the healthcare industry subject to market forces? And all of us, I think, with any kind of a free market orientation, say, of course it is. Of course it is. Look at LASIK surgery.
Right.
Look at plastic surgery. Look at the things that are outside of the third-party payment system. They're highly competitive and they're cost-effectively controlled.
And look how successful models that don't have to deal with government regulation have been, like the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, where people
exactly.
can... Exactly.
And in fact, Hal, as you point out, the Surgical Center of Oklahoma, in our 10th hour, we had a Skype visitor, Keith Smith, Dr. Keith Smith, an anesthesiologist, I might say, who spent an hour with our group. And we finished the course with a spectacular display of what free market forces and competition would do in health care. And we're not talking about LASIK surgery or plastic surgery. We're talking about gallbladders. We're talking about knee surgeries. We're talking about joint replacement. We're talking about, you know, many, many, many high-cost procedures that are done on a competitive model. And they are underselling or underpricing the hospitals, which are in great antagonism to Keith's enterprise, at one-sixth to one-tenth the cost.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a phenomenal example of free market healthcare.
So forget about international medical tourism. We have it in Oklahoma. You can go to Oklahoma and get quality care at a fraction of the cost that you can in most places around this country.
Right.
Yeah, and Dr. Smith told us that he's actually flying around the country helping doctors set up similar hospitals and systems in their particular locales. He's become like the Pied Piper of what's called direct care.
Well,
Jeff,
you can't do that right now.
Go.
You can't do that right now, it's my understanding, because of the Affordable Care Act, because there's a prohibition for setting up new physician-run hospitals. You have to buy an existing hospital.
The way it's prohibited is Medicare will not certify a physician-owned hospital.
I see.
But the Surgery Center of Oklahoma does not accept Medicare, Medicaid,
right?
Any insurance whatsoever. They're completely direct care.
Good point.
And as a result of that, their regulatory expenses are so low because once you accept Medicare, there's all sorts of requirements, including the electronic health record system, which only adds to cost and increases the risks of error. It doesn't really help anything. And all these other compliances that they have to, these compliance costs that they don't have anymore. So you could do it that way. Now, by the way, that's how they bought off the Hospital Association. They promised the Hospital Association they will bar competition from physician-owned hospitals if they support Obamacare.
Right, exactly. So it's the art of what's possible. And what is possible becomes even more possible if the court case that the Supreme Court is hearing right now, the King versus Burwell case, goes in favor of the plaintiffs. Would you care to comment on this case, fellas?
This is probably the biggest legal and actual challenge to the Affordable Care Act since the hearing in 2012, which you know allowed the constitutionality of the law to stand. Because John Roberts made it a tax, but that's history. What the issue is now, and this is a critical issue for the actual continuance of the Affordable Care Act or the survival of it, is the following. It was very clear back in 2009 and early 2010, Max Baucus is on record, as is Jonathan Gruber through multiple videos, saying that the states that don't establish their own health insurance exchange will be subjected to having a federal exchange, and if they have a federal exchange, they won't get any part of the $400 billion of subsidies that the federal government will give to people up to 400% of the poverty level. And that being so, they will not be forced to have an employer mandate and also an individual mandate. So in other words, if a state doesn't establish their own exchange, they basically, by the law, by the language in the law, they basically are opting out of Obamacare. Well, shortly after that occurred, after the law was passed, the IRS said, well, the intention of the law was to have subsidies for many, many Americans so that they can have affordable health care, and therefore that's how we're going to do it.
Actually, well, John, if I may, it's even worse than
30,
that.
30 seconds.
The IRS at first said, we got a problem. Only 36 states haven't set up exchanges. We're not allowed to give them subsidies in those states according to the way the law is written, because it's very explicit. It's written in 9 different places.
It's very clear, right.
And so they asked HHS Secretary Sebelius, what do we do? Because they expected all 50 states would sign up. And Sebelius said, go ahead and give it to them. And so that's actually in the record, in the complaint,
right,
which is even the IRS saw how the law is written, and they asked for instructions, and they were given instructions to give out the subsidies in those states that haven't set up exchanges.
So let's
and the way the law is written, because they were trying to avoid politically it being looking like a tax. They actually worded it in such a way that if there's no subsidy, then there's no employer mandate.
Okay.
Because the employer mandate is not written as a tax. It's written as a reimbursement for the subsidy.
Okay, take a break right here. Take a breath, and we're going to finish this up in the last segment. You're in the doctor's lounge. Thank you.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is Dr. George. Join me Wednesday mornings for Medicine on Call and participate in a lively conversation. Learn what's happening behind the headlines in medicine. Understand Obamacare. And learn how to protect yourself and navigate the system.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge in our final segment with Drs. John Ammon and Jeffrey Singer. And we're talking about the Supreme Court case that is central to whether or not Obamacare stands as is or is subject to a major catastrophic blow. So the case will be the decision will come down sometime in June. It's expected, and so if the Supreme Court says that that the states that the intent of the law was that anybody in Obamacare, whether it's a state or federal exchange, gets the subsidy, then the law stands. Then what happens?
Right. Well, if that's the case, then the tentacles of Obamacare basically sink into each state even further than it is, and that, in addition to all the Medicaid expansion, basically allows the law to kind of unfold and to happen. Although there will be a lot of responses and so forth by many components within the healthcare system to that, but by and large, that would be a kind of a setback for those of us who feel that the Affordable Care Act is perverse and not good for healthcare. If the decision by the Supreme Court, and again, remember, it's not a constitutional issue, Hal. It's, as you know, it's a statutory issue.
What does the law say?
Not how does the president or the IRS or the HHS secretary decide that how they want to read the law. It's what the law says. The language is so precise and so clear. Nothing ambiguous about it. So if the plaintiff wins, and remember, the plaintiff, this case went to the Supreme Court docket 72 hours after the last election. There's a lot of political overtones in this, but that being what it is, if the plaintiffs win, what it basically says is that the subsidies in states without a state exchange are no longer legal, or were never legal, but then they don't pertain anymore. And so there's going to be a outcry from one side that, you know, the Supreme Court just took away all this health care from 5 or 6 million people, and there's going to be an approach from the other side that's going to say, we're liberated in terms of health care decision making. We've got 36 states that do not have to play this game of subsidies that weren't written into the law. And so basically it's a frontal attack by both sides on each other to try to make the law either stand or continue or to replace it. And that's the key point this year. That's why this is the biggest year of Obamacare.
So Jeff, what happens?
A resolution.
So Jeff,
from a practical standpoint, if the King versus Burwell decides for the plaintiff King, then in the 36 states there is no longer any employer mandate. There's no longer an individual mandate for people who earn up to 400% of the poverty level, which is overall majority of Americans. and the subsidies disappear, so everybody's health insurance, that their premiums that are being disguised because the subsidies are artificially lowering them, they suddenly the real prices show up. So people are paying $100 a month are suddenly paying $500 a month.
Right. Do mandates,
the only thing that stays in place is all of these regulations.
Why do the mandates disappear?
Well, the way the law is written, like I was saying earlier, the employer mandate, this was like Gruber pointed out, if they told you it was a tax, then it wouldn't have passed. So the employer mandate is written as a reimbursement to the state for the subsidies that had to be given to their employees because they didn't provide their employees with health insurance. So King argues in the case that my state of Virginia doesn't have a state-based exchange, and therefore the people in my state shouldn't be getting subsidies, and therefore I shouldn't have to reimburse anybody, and therefore I shouldn't be penalized because I don't provide insurance for my employees. So basically the employer mandate would disappear if in the states that have no state-based exchanges because there's no subsidies for which to reimburse. And the individual mandate, the way it's written, is you're exempt from the individual mandate if you earn under 400% of the poverty level. But there are subsidies for you for up to 400% of the poverty level, so therefore you can't use the unaffordability exemption because you have no excuse. We're giving you a subsidy. But if the subsidy disappears, now you have that excuse.
So what do you?
So that's why it's all tied in.
So practically, what do you think happens if 36 states no longer can give subsidies?
So that's going to be a response by the United States Congress, and they're going to, and that is in play right now. The GOP is going to have to put forth, as they already have, a template anyway, a plan to rescue those 5 or 6 million people who would suddenly see their insurance costs quadruple or maybe disappear, provide a bridge over for insurance until next year or the year after when the congressional effort to replace the law or to rewrite the law or to repair the law, however it's going to play out, and there's no predictions about this and no one really knows, that's the big step, and that's what the Republican Congress, the Senate and the House now being one party, is working on feverishly and trying to get it done before the adjudication of this case, so that the Supreme Court, which is a political body, we know that from 2012, they can feel comfortable that there is a plan to rescue these people now who have been entitled to insurance and can't afford it.
The problem is that most people believe that if this was to happen, and which then basically forces Congress to act because in 36 states it's sort of chaos, almost any significant reform to the Affordable Care Act will be vetoed by the president because this is personal. It's got his name on it.
Yes.
So what they're probably, most of the people who are involved in policymaking are saying they'll probably have to come up with some sort of band-aid, like a temporary bridge until we have
right.
a new president. And
attached.
I'm serious about this. So, for example, they could do something, this is something that's been suggested, is you could pass a law saying in those 36 states, people will not be subject to the penalty of the individual mandate if they go back to buying the insurance that they liked that was canceled on them but wasn't quote-unquote ACA compliant. So the people who had their plans canceled because they were, you know, a 50-year-old couple, didn't have maternity benefits and dental care for kids and stuff like that, which is now required, and they were forced to go into the exchange, well, now they can go back to buying that. So
of course, that insurance,
until we work this out, we can go back to the way it was before.
Of course, that insurance product no longer exists, right, Jeff?
Right, but what they could do is, there's lots of discussions right now about what can be done, and one thing that might be done is, for example, you could say, Congress could say, these subsidies can remain in place until the end of the year, which will give the insurance companies 6 months to gear up products, get them back out there again, because that'll be a market in 36 states. That's a
right.
significant market.
You know, there are some that believe that that Congress is in somewhat of a dilemma, that they want to see Obamacare continue because the special interests, like the insurance companies, like the hospital cartel,
they want
to see this continue because they're making record profits
right
now, and they're spreading that money around from lobbyists on K Street.
Right, and they're going to be pushing states to set up state-based exchanges that don't have it because the pipeline of money going into the insurance companies from the taxpayer will have suddenly got cut off by a decision like this.
And the administration will come out in a grand way in the next couple of months that say if the plaintiff wins, then all that has to be done is Congress has to write a couple of typo corrections in the law to say that states without state exchanges, rather having federal exchanges, are entitled to subsidies. If they fix the law that way, then all these people with insurance now through Obamacare will no longer be deprived of health care and won't die and so forth. So there is a ideological and a language war that's coming over what is the way to address a victory by the plaintiff in this case. And it's going to be a real political war.
If I make something else beyond health care, a decision against the plaintiffs in this case has other consequences, because basically what happened is the law is so plainly written in 9 different places that subsidies are only available in states that have set up exchanges, and by state-based exchange we mean the 50 United States plus the District of Columbia plus the territories of Guam, etc. It's actually explicitly in there throughout the law.
Right.
So if the Supreme Court finds for the government, they're basically saying that any time a law doesn't fit the designs of the executive branch of government, the executive branch can unilaterally, without asking Congress, basically reconfigure the law to fit its designs. That would be basically ending the rule of law. So that has consequences beyond health care.
Huge consequences.
You think any law in the future that's passed that the president doesn't like, he could just say, well, I'm reinterpreting it this way, and he's now both the legislative branch and the executive branch.
Sort of like what he's doing right now already.
Right, so it's got very big implications beyond health care.
Yes, well, it's a couple of things. It's very, chilling about the implications of this will be if the law gets upheld, but even more so, I think that we're seeing every day something that's coming out in healthcare that it keeps it in the news. This is an issue that just won't go away, and I can't remember, before Obama, healthcare being such a front and center issue for the American public than it is right now.
Well, how I think that's a very interesting point. It wasn't front and center, but as Jeff and I went through the history of all of this, particularly since 1965 when Medicare and Medicaid and federal welfare was passed in the Great Society, and all the years since, right up until 2008, we documented, and we were aware of, but we documented it with great precision, what the actual problems were in the health care system. It wasn't with quality. It was with cost and financing. And it was the lack of market forces. It was the third-party payment mechanisms. All the things that occurred over the course of a century from World War II on and long before World War II in terms of what was needed for health care financing. And this is nothing new. I mean, we needed reform not in 2009, which was a complete upheaval of the healthcare system. We needed reform in 1965. We needed it in 75, 85. Yeah. As all these things began to evolve with the third-party mechanisms and then the federal intrusion into healthcare, there was great need for reforms. And there are reforms that are so excellent that could be market-based, that could radically reduce the cost of healthcare throughout America and also improve quality as physicians and scientists and medical schools and graduate medical education programs continue to improve quality, which is where quality is improved.
And that's
in fact, circling back to our opening, our course actually shows you that way back, by the time the 1930s and 40s are rolling around, you could see how, this is not a good idea. This is going to make this and this happen. We could see the whole story unfold.
Right. Well, this was a fascinating discussion. And when your course is more available to the rest of the public, I will be sure to share this with them on this show. And I just want to thank both of you for being our guests today in the Doctor's Lounge. This was a fantastic discussion.
It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Hal.
Okay. You've been in the Doctor's Lounge with Dr. Hal Schurz.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.